really believe I was okay. I went to urgent care the next morning and told a doctor about my many worrying symptoms. She took my vitals and poked my swollen foot and looked deep into my pupils, but not until I admitted to my anxiety did she have any answers. As soon as I did, it was like I'd said the magic word. She wrote me a prescription for 20 milligrams of Celexa, which I traded for Lexapro 2 weeks later after I didn't feel any better. On Lexapro, I experienced little to no side effects apart from a vague sense that I felt a bit too even-keeled. Nothing much bothered me, which bothered me. I missed my sometimes frantic energy, and I began to forget what it had felt like to be in the grips of my prolonged panic attack. So after about 7 months, I weaned myself off my meds, and it was fine. For 4 years, I thought of my anxiety as largely past tense. Maybe once a year, an alarming news story would convince me I was dying of an unlikely disease, but after a visit to the doctor in a couple of weeks, I'd be over it. Otherwise, anxiety didn't affect my daily life. I went to work and fulfilled all my responsibilities, real and self-imposed. I hung out with my friends when I wanted to and stayed home when I wanted to. Over the next few years, the latter happened more and more, but it happened so slowly I didn't notice. For a long time, I was pretty sure I was secretly an extrovert. Part of it was pride. I saw my introversion and my anxious tendencies as signs of weakness. Everyone thinks I'm shy, I'd say, but that's only because I'm quiet in group settings. I insisted on a distinction between shy, which I was not, and reserved, which I was. The former requiring a fear of confrontation and of speaking to strangers that I did not have, and the latter being a slowness to warm up to others, which I cannot deny. True introverts do not like being around people at all, I thought, and I do. Despite my many years being relatively contentedly single, I don't really care for being alone for extended periods of time. I don't need much me time. The only reason I got so much of it was because I liked being at home, and no one was home but me. It has become trendy, recently, to claim introversion as one's dominating trait, which is confusing for me. I always wanted to be more outgoing, more commanding a presence, louder, more socially skilled. The life of the party. Nobody has ever described me as the life of the party. I am lucky if I get, I'm pretty sure she was there. I arrive early and leave early. I don't drink very much. I've lost my tolerance for existing with a hangover, and I feel like I had more than enough alcohol in college to last a lifetime. During those years, I had a few shining moments in which I was, if not the most popular person at the party, the loudest. After a number of tequila shots that would probably kill me today, I would make myself known. Running home from the bar, screaming my way through a frat house, starting a dance floor in an inopportune location. Today, somehow, the cool thing, I'm basing this on the internet, is to be hot and sad and alone. I would say I grew up at the wrong time, but I was not a hot and sad teenager either. Alone, sure. I've never had the kind of lips one needs to make one's forlorn Instagram selfies pop. There's nothing mysterious or sexy or troubled about my wish to stay home alone. I'm just kind of boring. I love going to bed by 10 with my makeup washed off and my teeth brushed and flossed. I think a lot of people thrive off the unpredictability of going to one party and then another, but I hate it. Every time I'm about to go out and talk to people, I act like I've never talked to anyone before in my life. Seeing people I know well enough to greet but not well enough to maintain a reserve of conversation topics with stresses me out. I would rather stay home than have to think up a normal question I can ask someone after, "How are you?" and "How's work?" and "Do you know where the bathroom is?" I treat every social gathering like a bomb I can only defuse by rigorous, anticipatory worrying. I don't think any of these introverted tendencies are particularly great qualities to have, so I'm not sure why anyone brags about them. If a genie were to grant me 3 wishes, I would wish for world peace, universal student loan debt forgiveness, and some sort of pendant or ring that would make me into a social butterfly whenever I wore it. If there is one exception to my general distaste for big social gatherings, it is the formal dance. As a senior in high school, I brought a picture of the OC's Summer Roberts to my hairstylist and asked her to make my prom hair look like that. And little has changed since. I look forward to these rare and glamorous occasions like a lesser Austin sister looks forward to a ball. Thus, a few years ago, the night before my then employer's holiday party, which I couldn't help but refer to as the dance, I found myself again at the hairstylist with a picture in my hand. It's my life era Gwen Stefani. My hair was bleached platinum blonde then, too, and I was wearing a tuxedo jumpsuit, and I thought finger waves and red lipstick would pull the whole thing together perfectly. And it had to be perfect because, for the first time ever, I had an actual romantic date to a formal event. Lydia and I had started dating a few months earlier. When I woke up the next morning and took out the dozens of pins my hairstylist had set my hair in, my hair did not look like Gwen Stefani's hair. If anything, it looked more like Bon Jovi's It's My Life era hair. And from there, it was all downhill. Not because anything went that badly, but because already, as soon as I woke up, my mile-high expectations had failed me. My jumpsuit didn't fit like I wanted it to. I had a headache. My 3-inch heels already hurt. By the time I met Lydia at the venue, I was irretrievably crabby, which made her crabby with me in return, which made me even crabbier. I gulped down 2 gin and tonics, which, for me, in those days, was enough to cause a scene. Lydia tried to make me dance, and I refused. Apparently, once it became clear the night was not going to be the most magical night of my life, I decided instead to behave like a drunken Real Housewife at a fundraiser for underprivileged ponies. I pulled my friend Ariana away from her boyfriend to vent incoherently about nothing. I stomped my way over to the treat table, where I huffily assembled a plate of red and green Rice Krispies treats, and ate them one after another. Later that night, Lydia and I took a row of very cute photo booth pictures in which you cannot tell I am still seething, which is a miracle. The longer Lydia and I have been together, the easier it has gotten for me to let her talk me through one of my tailspins. Usually, she sees them coming on before I do. She likes to lift my arms above my head as I breathe in and lower them as I breathe out. I always feel stupid. It always helps. But I am stubborn, so it has taken me ages. I still don't particularly like having my anxiety pointed out to me. It's only okay when I say it. Coming from anyone else, I tend to interpret anxious as invalidating, as an insult. If Lydia suggested I take half a Xanax in the midst of a panic attack, what I heard was, "I can't handle you, and clearly you can't handle yourself." I did not see anxiety or depression as a sign of weakness in other people, but I used to see them that way in myself. I wasn't supposed to need anyone or anything. I didn't have this problem when I was single, I thought. When I later said the same thing to my therapist, she pointed out that I was plenty anxious when I was single, too. The only difference was that then there was nobody around to notice. Some months after the holiday party, after a number of needless, inexplicable pre-party arguments with Lydia and much internal debate, I asked my therapist if she thought it might be time for me to try a new medication. Broaching the subject was like pulling my own teeth. Being independent all those years had made me self-assured to the point that, for a long time, I insisted upon my anxiety and my social skittishness as integral parts of my personality. To seek medical intervention for them was to admit I was faulty, which to me felt like the kind of concession advice columnists are always telling you not to make. I had always relied very heavily on the mantra, be yourself. Now I wonder, how many of us are so great that being exactly ourselves is the best we can possibly be? My therapist prescribed me 20 milligrams of Prozac to be taken once a day. I have taken it faithfully for nearly 2 years, and I don't intend to stop taking it anytime soon, if ever. I feel so much better that I hate to think about how long I put off feeling better. For me, for now, there are no downsides. I am still anxious and frantic, and I still prefer being home to being out. I am very much not the life of the party, but I am, I think, a better version of myself than I was before. I don't know for sure if I need Lydia or if I need the Prozac, but I do know my life feels significantly easier because of them both, and I think that's good enough. Girl number 5. Andrea Carson from the Disney Channel original movie Motocrossed, age 15. A very loose adaptation of Shakespeare's Twelfth Night, Motocrossed is the story of a girl named Andrea who just wants to ride bikes, but because her dad thinks motocross isn't for girls, she must do so in secret. But then, her brother gets injured before a big race, so Andrea, unbeknownst to her family, cuts her hair short like a boy's and enters the race in her brother's place. There are a few scenes in which other girls, believing Andy to be a boy, are shown flirting with her, and it wasn't hard to see why. Even for a Disney Channel original movie, it was intensely homoerotic. Chapter 13. Pride. Not long after Lydia and I started dating, I went home with her to San Diego for a Thanksgiving vacation. She gave me a tour of the neighborhood where she grew up, the middle school and high school, the soccer field where she'd been the star player, The hill she rollerbladed down so fast she had to dive into a bush to stop herself. The older she got, the further all her personal historic landmarks took us from her mother's house. Once we got into her early 20s, we drove into Hillcrest, the city's gay neighborhood, and there she took me to a lesbian bar called Gossip Grill. "Gossip Girl?" I said. "Gossip Grill." I'd been in gay bars several times before, with a friend of mine in college, as an ostensibly straight woman who just wanted to dance, but never to a specifically lesbian one. I was nervous. For one thing, Lydia had told me this was where she used to hang out with her ex and their friends. They had, in fact, had the first of their two breakups on the bar's dance floor on St. Patrick's Day. Ah, to be young. Though it was a Tuesday night, we were both steeling ourselves for the possibility of a run-in. Walking up to the bar in the dark, I felt like I was approaching a haunted house. But it wasn't just the spectral ex that I was afraid of. I was also afraid that the lesbians in the lesbian bar would see me and realize that I did not belong there. Never mind that I was wearing, on purpose, the gayest outfit I owned. A tropical print short-sleeved shirt buttoned all the way up, black skinny jeans, high-top tennis shoes, or that I was there with the woman I was sleeping with. I still felt like a fake. I was freshly 29, and I'd been gay for a grand total of 5 months. My heart beat fast in my chest as I handed the female bouncers my ID, and I worried, as I have worried every time I've entered a bar since I turned 21, that I would be refused entry. Only this time, I wasn't worried it would be because my hair was a different color from the photo, or because, unbeknownst to me, I was actually underage and not almost 30. Instead, I imagined the woman who grabbed my ID taking a brief look at it, and another at my face, and saying, "Sorry, not gay enough." Obviously, this did not happen. The bouncers did not care any more about me than they did anyone else they let in. While Lydia got us each a drink, I scanned the room, looking for the ex, mercifully absent, and gaping. I don't know what I'd expected. That's not true. I expected the planet from the L word. But this wasn't it. It was just a bar. The only immediately visible differences were the utter lack of men present and the higher than average number of vests, and the semi-sapphic posters and prints hanging on the walls. Lydia and I found a table by the windows just off the dance floor, presently empty, and I looked at it, for God knows what reason, picturing a dramatic reenactment of Lydia's breakup with her ex. "So what do you think?" said Lydia. "It's fine," I said. What I meant was, I was exactly as uncomfortable as I am in every other kind of bar, and I wanted to leave the exact same amount. About 5 minutes later, all of Lydia's old friends showed up. First she saw two walk in, and then they just kept coming until I counted 7, maybe 8, just about every hometown friend of hers I'd heard about, minus, thank God, the ex-girlfriend. We stood up and shook hands and hugged and were introduced. Lydia hadn't even told them she was in town, which made a few of the friends scold her briefly, which made me feel territorial. It was strange to be around people who'd known her for so long, knowing how much she'd wanted to get away and start over. I don't typically spend a lot of time comparing myself to her exes, because she's never given me any reason to think that I should. I am also arrogant enough to assume that I am better for her, and perhaps naive enough to believe that one's relationships progress in a steady upward trajectory. Still, sitting in the presence of all these women from Lydia's former life, in a lesbian bar that used to be her lesbian bar, I wondered how I measured up to the girl who used to sit in my place. Lydia's friends were very nice to me. Some more than others, maybe, but no one was rude and no one ignored me. Everyone asked me what I did for work and where I was from, and as usual, I was so focused on trying to make myself seem friendly that I forgot to ask enough questions in return. I was trying too hard to hear everything that everyone around me was saying to focus on any one of them. One of the girls there had apparently broken up with a long-term girlfriend only a few months earlier and, according to the others, was now hooking up with every 22-year-old girl she could find. Another of them, the one I knew to be the ex's best friend, talked about her long-distance relationship with a woman who lived in Australia. And another, who was evidently in love with that best friend, complained about a girl who'd recently stopped texting her. I felt like a freak then, and I feel like one now, retelling it, because I was a little too rapt and too wide-eyed, and I worried I was staring. Even after I'd come out, I was fascinated by lesbians being lesbians and talking about lesbians, to a degree that didn't seem fitting for someone who now identified as one herself. "Everyone around me is a woman talking about sleeping with women," I wanted to yell. "Is everyone hearing this?" I still couldn't quite believe a place full of people like these ones existed, and I still couldn't quite believe I was one of them. When we left the bar a little over an hour later, I wanted to know everything about everyone we'd met and their relationships past and present. In bed that night, I looked most of them up on Instagram because I wanted to see what everyone they'd talked about looked like, because I was then, and am still, getting used to the idea that there isn't any one particular way that queer women look. Lydia did her best to humor me and answer my many detailed questions, but for her, this wasn't some fascinating new world she'd only just entered. She'd been there for almost 15 years. To her, this was normal. I asked her if she missed her hometown queer scene, and she said yes, sometimes. Not so much that bar in particular, though that too, and not all the individual people she left behind, but the sense of community she felt when she was there with them. It's a belongingness I haven't really gotten to experience, the kind I've been searching for ever since. A few weeks before I met Lydia, the company where I worked had a big party for Pride Week. Although I'd only really come out to two friends from work, and even then not as gay or bisexual, but as someone who was thinking about it and would get back to you in 7 to 365 business days. When I walked into that party, I was surprised to find I felt like I truly belonged there. Even if nobody else there knew it, I did. My friends and I got drinks at the bar, then gathered around a jar full of bright yellow stickers that said things like queer and hella gay. Everyone took a few and stuck them to their clothes, unconcerned with which ones they wore and what it meant to do so. Many of them were straight and just liked free stickers. I stuck one of each on my chest, thrilled at having all these new terms to apply to myself. That night I drank too much and danced too sloppily, but I was happy. Being in such an explicitly queer space lifted a weight off my shoulders I hadn't even known was there. The relatively few crushes I'd had on other women before that night had always felt unserious or winky, the way women's magazines talk about the readers' collective girl crush on the newest, prettiest, famous 20-year-old. But being at that party, surrounded by girls who were dancing together and flirting with one another and kissing, I felt empowered to take my queerness seriously. I could look at women not just as the kind of people I made friends with, but as the kind of people I might one day love. My sexuality, however late it had come to me, however it had shifted, and might shift again, was real and worthy. It was okay that I didn't have a word for it, or a story that made sense to other people. I gave myself permission to meet my heart where it was. Like so much else, this was easier decided than done. When I went to the Pride Parade the next day, I felt uncomfortable taking a spot on my company's float alongside the people I thought of as actually queer. The out ones, the ones who always knew, the ones who knew what it felt like to have their hearts broken by unrequited love for their middle school best friends. So I walked alongside them, searching the crowd for something that might make everything clear. I wanted people to see me, believe me. Maybe I wanted someone to yell something at us or hold up some sign for us that would convince me of my belonging by grouping us together. I wanted assurance that nobody else thought of me as an imposter, even if I still felt like one, even as I knew there wasn't anyone out there who could do that for me but me. When I'd walked for about an hour, much of it in the rain, hungover, and after a four-hour delay on our float's start time, I snuck away from the pack, weaving as quickly as I could through the hundreds of people pressed against the barricades. As I always do when escaping a crowded event and or social situation, I immediately felt 100 times better. I was happy to have been there, but I was even happier to be on my way home, where everything had stayed the same. I don't know how paranoid I'm being. I have to assume it's at least a little. But I get the sense that when I talk to straight women about guys now, my opinion matters less than it did when I was one of them. How much of that is owed to the fact that I am not single, and how much is owed to the fact that I am dating a woman, I don't know. Some of it, surely, is that I find myself less interested in hearing about men, and presumably, my friends can tell. There is a particular kind of commiseration done between women who date men, and for so much of my life, it was my favorite thing to do. Anytime I met a woman who had a crush on a guy, I wanted to know everything about it. The backstory, the eye contact, the signs, the texts. I have had this conversation with women I worked with at the Writing Center where I tutored in college, with women I met drunk in frat house bathrooms, with women I bought coffee from, and pretty much every girl I ever sat next to, in front of, or behind in every high school class and college class I've ever taken. I have been the friend that other girls refer their friends to when they are tired of hearing about a boy and need someone else to fill in for a while. I don't think this was necessarily because I ever had anything especially insightful to say, and it certainly wasn't because I understood men or how to ensnare them. I was just eager and wanted to hear every last detail. Not everyone wants the exact timeline, spelling, and punctuation of the text conversation you had with the boy you like, but I do. Or at least, I did. When I came out, I assumed I would continue to relate to my existing friends the way I always had. I hoped I would make new friends, queer ones, whom I could relate to in another way, but it did not occur to me that the dynamics between me and my straight friends would change. Boys made up a lot, probably too much, of what we'd talked about over the years, but there was so much I hadn't even experienced yet. Now that I was actually in a relationship, there was a brand new world of neuroses I needed to process, repeatedly, with as many friends as would listen. But it did not take me long to figure out that asking friends for relationship advice is a very mixed bag, and that I'd been overconfident and overeager in dispersing so much of it over the years. I learned that fraught text exchanges with someone who is ambivalent about you at best can make for great, dishy, happy hour conversations, but recapping the pleasantly domestic weekend you had with your steady girlfriend does not. I'd rather the latter over the former, hands down, but there is something sad in unclenching your fist around that specific kind of agony. I hated feeling fed up and frustrated and unsure if the person I liked would ever like me back, but I missed the blind support that came along with it. How tender toward me and how brutal on my behalf were my friends when a man let me down. But now I have no men to speak of. It used to be that I'd meet up with a writer friend of mine for brunch every 3 or so months, and each time she would ask about the guy I'd hopefully told her about last time. Then I would spend half an hour recounting everything that went wrong since I saw her last, and she'd perform outrage, stabbing her fork into brioche French toast and suggesting I get my revenge by dating 4 guys at once. We did not know a lot about each other, but she always remembered the names of the guys I liked, and she always made me feel so much better when it turned out they did not like me. The last time I saw her, she was weeks away from her wedding, and I had just started dating Lydia. We were so happy for each other. We talked for just an hour. For months, I kept meaning to email her, to set up another brunch. But it's been over a year since then, and I suspect we've lost the rhythm. It is a good sign, I know, not having a lot of drama or insecurity to contend with in a relationship. I suppose it's a good thing that I don't need as much support from as many friends as I used to. And my friends are probably relieved to no longer have to give so much of it. But I miss them. I am mostly very content, and I am confident that the person I love loves me. I am also a little lonely in a way I did not expect. The thing I used to talk about most and bond over most is all but gone, and I haven't been able to figure out how to replace it. In the summer of 2016, I went to New York City's Pride March for the first, and maybe last, time as an officially out gay person. This time I didn't march with my job. I don't actually recall being given the option. Either way, I didn't want to. I wanted to attend as a spectator, and I wanted to go with my newish gay friends. A few months earlier, Lydia's best friend, and, as it happens, first high school girlfriend, Jenna, and Jenna's then-girlfriend, Caitlin, followed her example and moved across the country from San Diego to Brooklyn. I was both nervous and excited for them to arrive, knowing even as I was doing it that I was placing all my best lesbian couple friends' hopes and dreams on 2 women I'd never met. Up until Pride, we hadn't actually seen them a whole lot. Not for any major reason other than an accumulation of tiny misalignments between who we were and what we liked to do when we were not at work. Pride, though, was something we could agree on. 2 weeks earlier, a racist and homophobic security guard named Omar Mateen had murdered 49 people and injured 53 others inside Pulse, a gay club in Orlando, Florida. Pulse was hosting Latin Night, which was likely a major factor in Mateen's timing. Most of the victims were Latinx, and many of them were immigrants. The shooting was the deadliest act of violence against queer people in U.S. history, and the deadliest terrorist attack here, period, since 9/11. I do not often feel singled out by hatred in this country. I am white and comfortably middle class. Many people hate women, but I guess I am used to all the ways that particular venom flows through my daily life. Before the Orlando shooting, anti-LGBTQ violence was something that happened to other people. It was devastating, but it was not personal. I was not at risk for that particular form of bigotry. I am still much safer than most. Still, Orlando created a possibility I had never before considered for myself. So it seemed extra important that year to be at Pride. and I wanted to be around all the people who understood why. Also attending with us was another queer couple we knew from our Brooklyn neighborhood. One of the pair, Sellers, was, like me, in her first ever same-sex relationship, and it would be her first pride as a queer woman, too. So I suppose I imagined the six of us going there together and experiencing some kind of rainbow-heavy communal gay transcendence. No matter if we weren't all that close when we left for the parade, when we got back from it, we would be inseparable. Suffice it to say, I did what I always do before a big event or holiday. Set myself up for disappointment. First of all, we were late. I'd been made to play it by ear, which in my experience means that several things will go wrong and I won't be allowed to get mad about it. By the time the six of us actually found one another along the parade route, the last handful of floats were making their way down Christopher Street. We wound through the crowd, getting as close as we could to the metal railings without touching the backs of the people in front of us. If I stood on my tiptoes, I could just barely make out Samira Wiley and Natasha Lyonne and Dasha Polanco walking beneath the Orange is the New Black float. Feeling claustrophobic and completely unable to hear one another speak, we agreed by hand gesture to make our way over to Pride Fest. Pride Fest had been described to me as a gay street fair with art and shopping and free food, which sounded great. The reality was much closer to a student orientation fair at a college campus, only instead of signing up to join 10 clubs whose meetings you'd never attend, you could sign up to receive brand emails. We walked down the street, lined on either side with plastic-covered booths and awnings, and every time I passed one for a life insurance company or a granola bar company, I assumed I was getting closer to the real Pride Fest. Up front, maybe, it was all marketing, but there was supposed to be more. Who had told me there would be art? Who had told me that any of this would be queer? Truly, the only thing separating the fest from every other fair I've attended in a high school gym was that the brands were pandering to gay people instead of just young ones. Mostly this meant that their banners and t-shirts had rainbows on them. Some companies fit in more successfully than others, and ultimately I'd rather buy from a brand that is at least willing to align itself with gay people than refuse them outright, but walking down that street I felt repulsed, not proud. And I am no righteous consumer. I buy things off Amazon all the time. I have little to no ground to stand on as far as any rejection of capitalism goes. I still don't know exactly what I'd expected or hoped for. I just know it wasn't that. After we reached the end of the stalls, the six of us split up into our three respective couples, despite my dreams of instant best friendship. Each pair of us was vaguely annoyed with the way the others were handling the parade's crowds. I was mildly devastated. On our walk to the subway, Lydia and I sat on someone's steps to complain. And then, feeling helpless as to what to do or think or feel about Orlando now that the media had mostly moved on, hating that an event ostensibly created to celebrate and to heal felt so empty and so crassly commercial, upset with myself for having expected a parade to be life-changing and for ending up annoyed with everyone I went with instead, I cried. Here was the one day a year specifically dedicated to queer community and celebration, and there we were, alone, together, wondering what to do now. That I had Lydia there with me was no minor source of happiness and relief, but I wanted so much more. Not very long after we'd stopped, a group of women walked by us holding solo cups and singing. When they saw us, they said hi, and rather generously asked if we wanted some of their pot. When we demurred, they asked if they could take a selfie with us, so we did. I never saw the photo, and I can only hope it wasn't too obvious that I had been crying. This was the best part of the whole day for me, seeing and being seen by other queer women, huddling together and smiling because it was our special day, and we had that one thing in common. Chapter 14, Women's Studies 101. Lydia often points other people's gawking out to me, a tendency which, early on in our relationship, usually made me roll my eyes. She would come home from work and tell me about a customer who stared at her a beat too long while paying for her coffee, and I would groan, thinking she wanted me to be jealous. Or we'd be walking to our favorite sushi place for dinner, and she would pull gently on my arm and ask, "Did you hear those guys laughing at us?" I never noticed it myself, and so I assumed she was imagining things. "Not everyone is always looking at you," I'd tell her. We live in Brooklyn, in a neighborhood that, to me, seems dense with queer women. It isn't at all uncommon to see a pair of women holding hands as they walk down the sidewalk. I know because my eyes are drawn to them like moths to a big gay flame. I knew there were many places in the world in which we'd stand out, but Brooklyn and New York City at large wasn't one of them. I don't know why exactly I was so eager to disbelieve her. If anyone who wasn't my own girlfriend had been the one telling me that someone had treated them differently for being queer, I would have believed them without reservation. Or maybe I just want to think I would. How could it happen as much as Lydia said it did when half the time I was right next to her and I never saw anything? Maybe it just seemed impossible that it could happen, was happening, consistently, to someone I lived with and loved. And if it could happen to someone this close to me, then maybe it could happen to me, too. I sometimes feel a sort of lingering guilt about how relatively easy it was for me to come out. It's totally unproductive and self-involved, and perhaps a little masochistic to spend any time thinking about how I should have had to suffer more for my sexuality, but I can't help it. It's not that I think I deserve to be discriminated against. It's that I don't think anyone does, and it doesn't seem fair that I should have weathered my coming out as smoothly as I did. After I came out to everyone I knew, and later to everyone I didn't, I went about my life paying very little attention to how people responded to my relationship. I'm a little spacey to begin with, often walking by people I know without realizing because I am looking at the pavement, absorbed in my thoughts. But it also took me a while to get used to the idea that I was no longer presumed normal. The little things caught up to me. At night, in unfamiliar neighborhoods, I would instinctively keep my hand thrust inside my pocket when I might otherwise reach for my girlfriend's hand. I learned to distinguish a curious glance from a disapproving one. A couple of summers ago, I booked a cabin for Lydia and me over the phone, and I reflexively referred to her as my friend. When we arrived for check-in months later, the skittish, off-put reaction of the cabin's middle-aged female manager to Lydia's appearance, androgynous, makeupless, the sides of her head shaved, seemed to confirm that I had been right to be cautious. But then I wondered if I was just being paranoid. Back in the car, I asked Lydia if she thought the manager had looked at us weird. Of course she did, she said. Look at me. As soon as Lydia was old enough to talk, she began to protest her clothes. There is a picture of her, my favorite picture of her, at 4 years old, wearing a frilly dress at her uncle's wedding. She looks desperately unhappy. Her mouth is a perfect upside-down semicircle. Eventually, her mother gave in to her requests and let her wear what she wanted. Around that same time, her mom received an anonymous letter from a self-described, concerned mother, presumably of one of Lydia's preschool peers, advising her that if she continued to let her little girl wear boys' clothes, she would end up a lesbian. She threw it away and let Lydia wear what she wanted, which I am grateful for, especially because of the pictures. I know what Lydia's favorite childhood outfit was because she has described it to me at least 7 times. A pair of what she calls Beetlejuice pants, worn with a white button-up shirt, a black vest and cummerbund, and a top hat. At 6 years old, she had her hair cut short and slicked it back with water in order to look more like her idol, Zach Morris. When she was in kindergarten, a group of eighth-grade girls told her she was in the wrong bathroom, and after that, she was so afraid to go into public women's bathrooms that she'd hold it as long as she possibly could, and once peed her pants in a bathroom stall because she hadn't gotten there quite quickly enough. She still hates public restrooms. On her trip to Paris, at the Musée de l'Armée, a guard called out to stop her from going into the women's bathroom with me. I don't speak French, but I knew enough to know he was asking if she was a man or a woman. Femme, I hissed, and if I'd known how, I would have also said, and mind your own fucking business. Lydia was annoyed, but she was also used to it. Once, she and I were sitting on the subway holding hands when a group of Russian-speaking tourists, 2 men and 2 women, got on a few stops after ours. As usual, I didn't pay them much attention beyond registering their foreign language and exuberant touristness. I was thinking only of lunch. We got off the train at 14th Street, and once we were safely out of earshot, she said, they were talking about us. Who? I said. The Russians. How do you know? I asked. I knew the answer. Lydia took 2 years of Russian in college. But sometimes, in a relationship, it's nice to needlessly challenge your partner's expertise on something they like to brag about, like knowing how to speak a little Russian. They said, lesbians, and girls, and illegal, said Lydia. And they wouldn't sit by us. Really? I asked. Yes. Maybe they said, those girls make a beautiful lesbian couple, and it's truly a shame that homosexuality is illegal in our country, I offered, optimistically. If I teased her, if I made a joke, I thought, maybe it would hurt less. I don't know. I don't think so, said Lydia, and I didn't really think so either. When I was a senior in high school, my civics teacher assigned me to argue against legalizing gay marriage in a mock debate. We were working our way through the typical high school civics class debate topics. The war in Iraq, torture, capital punishment, welfare, abortion, and, finally, gay marriage. And though he did not say so explicitly, my suspicion was that my teacher was assigning students to argue against the positions he assumed they held. Or else it was just a coincidence that all of the popular kids in the class, Young Life Christians every last one, were made to argue for abortion rights and against the death penalty. I'm sure the intent was to make us learn a little something about the other side and come out of class a little wiser for it, but like so many other high school teen projects, it mostly served to strengthen the inalienable supremacy of the popular kids. There were more of them in that classroom than there were of the rest of us, and somehow they were all friends, which in turn made it harder to debate them, even the dumb ones. So there were two reasons I didn't want to argue against legalizing same-sex marriage. One, because I hate losing, and two, because I was very much in favor of equal marriage rights. So much so, in fact, that when I received my assignment, I went to my teacher after class to ask if I could possibly switch sides. I do not remember crying, but after a later parent-teacher conference, my parents told me my teacher had said I cried. And if I did, why not keep that between us, Mr. H? My parents did not need more evidence of my uncoolness. My teacher was sympathetic, but he did not let me switch teams, which was the correct teacher move to make. To prepare for my debate, I printed off a bunch of excerpts from Christian philosophy papers and the Bible and old-school psychologists who argued that for a child to grow up healthy, he needed to be raised by one woman and one man. My team won, which was obviously bittersweet. For most of my life, my politics revolved around what I perceived to be the issues I faced as a woman. Toward the end of high school, I got into politics, and more specifically, a very introductory, very second wave, very white kind of feminism. Although heading into college as a freshman, my extracurriculars were limited to friends, boys, drinking, and the drama that ensued as a result of all three, as a sophomore and a newly declared political science major, I saw a flyer for a Feminist Majority Leadership Alliance meeting and decided I should, as our career counselors like to say, get involved. At the very first meeting I went to, the current president announced there would be elections for new leadership the following week because she and the vice president were both seniors and wanted the transition of power over our 6-member club to be as painless as possible. So with one whole meeting under my belt, I decided I wanted to be the group's next president. My campaign was a 30-second speech about my interest and my organizational ability. My opponent was a junior who seemed like the kind of person who had missed half the meetings for eccentric spiritual reasons, so I won. I'd persuaded my roommate Joyce to join my platform as vice president by insisting it would be good for her eventual medical school application, and promising I would basically do all the work myself, a move I now recognize as somewhat despotic. Our new treasurer ran reluctantly and unopposed. Being feminist president gave me a sense of purpose and identity like I'd never experienced before. There was a brief period in middle school when I was the spelling bee kid, but I was neither the only nor the best one, so it didn't really count. I'd never felt like part of a team before, really, either. My athletic record revealed a string of sports I tried for one season before quitting as soon as I realized I'd never be a star. I quit clarinet, dare, yearbook, and Spanish club. Eventually, I had tennis to count on, but I never got great. And as far as team bonding and social clout go, tennis isn't exactly basketball or soccer. I relished being a part of something bigger, and unsurprisingly, I found it delightful to be in charge. I loved emailing discussion topics and relevant articles to our listserv the day before our meetings, and then feeling indignant when attendance was poor or nobody had much to say, both of which happened often. I loved coordinating with the business office and the school events planner and local companies to organize our annual women's health fair like a grown-up with an actual job. I loved walking around campus with Joyce in the evenings to tape up posters. And I really loved writing angry letters to the editor of our school's terrible student newspaper when they published something sexist, typing under my name, President, FMLA. I ran all the same second waiver events my predecessor before me had run. The Equal Pay Bake Sale, the Take Back the Night marches, the Vagina Monologues performances, the Love Your Body campaigns. All the usual feminism 101 fare. All of it important and well-meant and valid enough. Very little of it as universally pressing or as progressive as I considered it then. Though even this entry-level feminism was too much for plenty of people, and how I loved the righteous outrage I felt when I saw one of our handmade posters defaced, or when a male student stopped by the bake sale to tell me the wage gap was fake. Our most daring and most poorly attended event was a joint pro-choice march we held with Illinois State, which has an enrollment of about 20,000. Maybe 20 people showed up, which was fine because my vice president and I were profoundly hungover, having scheduled the march for the Sunday after all the fraternities held their Halloween parties. Being the outspoken feminist on campus also gave me another reason why I never seemed to get anywhere with guys, and I was always looking for more of those. I don't know what it's like on college campuses now, but in 2007, the only thing straight boys wanted less to do with than the campus feminist club was the Gay Straight Alliance. During Love Your Body Week, I sat outside the cafeteria at a folding table during lunch, trying to get people to circle their favorite body part on a piece of paper featuring the generic outline of a human body, which I'd printed 300 of in the library. It was hard enough getting anyone to stop when food was so near, and then the crowds of frat boys would pour in through the doors, smirking when they saw the big FMLA sign. Occasionally, one of them would come over to circle a crotch. On the second or third day of this, I saw my sort of friend Eric, a senior who played for the men's tennis team and who'd kissed me once at a party. When he saw me, he said, "Katie, you're a feminist?" in the same sort of tone you might use to ask someone if they are currently picking their nose. I saw myself in that instant as Alice Paul or Margaret Sanger or any of the other historical white women I was learning about in my Women's Studies 101 class. My chest puffed up and I jutted out my chin and I said, "Yes, I am." Because most of the boys I went to school with were so visibly turned off by even the word feminism, and because feminism was my thing, it felt a little less hurtful and a little more righteous when we didn't get along. It wasn't that I didn't like guys, period. I just didn't like guys who were sexist, and as far as I could tell, that was most of them. And it wasn't that guys didn't like me because they could tell I didn't like them. They didn't like me because I was a proud feminist, and that scared them. The best thing a friend or magazine can give you when you are a single straight woman is the idea that you are single because you're intimidating. Honestly, what could be more flattering? The older I got and the more men I met, the less I liked them. And the less I liked them, the easier it was to think of them as this one big, bad thing. It's not like it's particularly hard to find evidence if your working hypothesis is that all men are bad. One must simply go online. But in mistaking my own discomfort with dating men for some sort of political enlightenment, my feminism got whittled down into something myopic and powerless. I reveled in self-pity. I made it too simple. Men bad, women good. It used to be so easy to feel right, which has to be one of the main perks of being 22. It was at that age that I got an equal sign, for feminism specifically, tattooed on the inside of my right wrist. Not since then have I been remotely as sure that my side of any argument is the right one. Not since then have I believed that most people agree on essential human rights and values, and all they need to see that is a good, clear presentation of the facts. By the time I finished my public policy graduate program, I felt disheartened and depressed by what I had learned. Mainly, that people rarely change their minds, and when they do, it's to get more conservative as they age. That you should never take a poll or a politician's word at face value. And that getting the government to do much of anything good takes decades. The starry-eyed political fervor with which I'd ridden in a van full of college Democrats to Indiana to canvass for Barack Obama had been all but drained from my body by the time I graduated. At the time, I resented policy school for making me lose faith in government. Now I wonder if that was kind of the point, and maybe everyone should have to go. The Supreme Court ruled in favor of federally recognized same-sex marriage the summer I came out. About 10 years after I'd argued against it in civics class. And that victory matters a lot. But I wonder if in 100 years we will treat 2015 as the year everything changed for all American queer people, the way we treat 1920 as the year everything changed for all American women. When my mostly white women's studies classmates and I talked about suffrage, we marveled over the fact that we had gained the right to vote only 90 years earlier. Never mind that women and men of color were frequently disenfranchised until the Voting Rights Act was ratified in 1965, and ignoring that voter suppression still happens today. The equal pay bake sales I helped organize charged men $1 per cookie and women 75 cents, never mind that that ratio described white wage earners only. And yet I was so sure we were radical and seeing things so much more clearly than everyone else. Maybe the law that makes it legal for me to marry my girlfriend seems less like the paradigm-shifting legislation I thought it was at 18, because now I'm 30, and that law actually applies to my life, and I can see that it hasn't made everything fair. Under the Trump administration, it feels low on the list of urgent concerns. But maybe I'll regret my lack of fear for myself 2 years from now. If Trump's election taught me anything, it's that things can always get worse than you imagine. I have to remind myself that there are people out there, lots of them, who find me inferior and immoral. That I am still able to be surprised by intolerance and hatred is a function of how privileged I have been. I'm a white, middle-class, cisgendered woman who came out as an adult living in New York City during the Obama administration. I took it for granted that my rights as a woman and a newly out queer person were the safest they'd ever been and would only continue to get safer. I was so sure that Hillary Clinton would win the election that I served for a while as on-demand reassurance to my more worried friends. Kiara would text me a screenshot of an unfavorable new poll, and I would text back, "Polls don't mean anything. Trust me." Well, I don't know much of anything, but I know more than I did 10 years ago when I thought I knew everything. And while I had a lot of fun believing I knew everything, I would have been better off if I'd given it up sooner. Perhaps I could have done more with my little feminist administration than awareness campaigns and bake sales. Because feminism is, has to be, about more than loving our bodies and empowering our sexuality and celebrating badass white ladies throughout history. I am embarrassed I subscribed to that version of feminism for as long as I did. I am embarrassed I once considered marriage equality the civil rights movement of our time when the black civil rights struggle was, and is, very much ongoing. When I experience sexism, I experience it as a white woman. When I experience anti-queer prejudice, I experience it as a cisgendered gay woman living in a big, progressive city. My perspective is limited. There is so much I do not know. The day after President Trump was inaugurated, I went to the Women's March in Manhattan, and as I walked, I watched the teenagers and college kids. Their signs and their face paint and outfits were unquestionably superior to everyone else's, in design and humor and inclusive messaging alike, and their chants were the catchiest and loudest. It was a great day, beautiful and uplifting and invigorating after a couple of months' worth of disbelief and despair. It wasn't perfect, and it wasn't enough in itself to change things. It was still very early, and Trump hadn't had enough time to do much yet. But it was heartening. And when the president does something despicable, and he finds a way most days, and I feel overcome by my weird, useless helplessness and my grown-up cynicism, I try to think instead of the many young people I saw at the march. Proudly queer and black and Latinx and immigrant and feminist, already so aware of just how much those things can mean. Chapter 15. Roommates. I have never in my life wanted an apartment to myself. Maybe it would have been different had I been forced to go the Craigslist route, but for 10 years, I lived with best friends. When I started thinking I might want to move to New York, there was only one potential roommate in my mind, Kiara. Ours is the easiest, most seamless transition from strangers to friends that I have ever made. As roommates, we were companionable, if not inseparable, like Riley and I had been. We watched the Today Show together in the mornings before going to work, and one or two nights a week ordered heaps of buttery pasta and bread from our favorite delivery place, and ate it on TV trays in our 70-square-foot living room. She was not around as often as I was, but she was there when it counted. When I was dumped by the man I'd briefly dated shortly after moving to New York, Kiara made me get out of bed and go on a ghost tour of the historical home museum where she volunteered as a guide, because it was almost Halloween. I stood in the back of the group, the guides playing clips from recordings taken by ghost hunters, and tried not to cry. Then we rented Bridget Jones's Diary from a combination pizza place slash video rental shop in the East Village. When Kiara broke up with a boyfriend I hated, we watched Eurovision on her laptop in her bed for 2 days straight. When we first moved in together, everyone, including us, thought it was funny that I'd written a book about how bad I was at dating, and Kiara had written an actual guidebook on it called Modern Dating, a Field Guide. This dynamic was omnipresent in our relationship as friends and roommates. I asked for boy advice, and she gave it. I complained about my bad dating luck, and she told me I needed to put myself out there more. I went on dating apps largely because I felt I had to prove to her that I was trying. I dated a little, but not so much that it ever really took me away from her. She was single for the first 5 months we've lived together, but even then it felt like she knew something I didn't. Then she got a boyfriend, and I was sure of it. That boyfriend, beyond being annoying in a more general sense, was also fairly hot and cold with Kiara, and so she was still around a fair amount, even if she would have preferred to be with him. When he was busy with work or otherwise engaged, we stayed in and watched reality TV, and the only real difference was that she kept her phone in her hand. But they broke up, and a month later, Kiara met Mark, and it was clear very early on that this relationship was going to be different. They had their literal third date in Italy. She was going to visit family and made a joke about him coming to visit, and then he bought a plane ticket. He proposed while they were there. She said no, not yet. I was briefly aghast until I met him. Right away I liked him, and I liked them together. So when she started hanging out with him every night, and, unsurprisingly, that happened pretty quickly, it was a little easier to bear than if it had been a guy I liked less. But only a little. When I complained to friends that Kiara had abandoned me and left me the apartment to myself, they told me I had it made. I disagreed. When Kiara really lived with me, there was a chance that I would end up doing something with my day that I had not been planning to do from the moment I woke up. Without her, there was nobody around to pull me out of the routine I'd made for myself. I was never going to be surprised to find, after walking up the 5 flights of stairs to our apartment, that the lights were on and she was home. I'm making it sound like Kiara died. Mark's apartment was 20 blocks away. They invited me to things. He tried hard, especially relative to other boyfriends I've known. For a while, they made a point of staying at our place a few nights a week. Then she'd just come by on Sundays to hang out with me and swap out her dirty clothes for clean ones. We'd order pasta and watch an old musical, and in the morning, she would go home. Then, over the holidays, they went to Peru together for 10 days, and after that, she didn't come back. It had gotten too hard to pretend like what was obviously happening wasn't happening. She lived with someone else. And despite my best efforts, I lived alone. I hated every second. So 3 months later, and 4 months before the Manhattan lease I shared with Kiara was up, I moved to Brooklyn. She and I found a pair of subletters, and I signed a new lease on a beautiful apartment that felt, comparatively speaking, like a mansion. I was living with my good friend Rachel, and I was excited not only because I loved her and loved her new apartment, but because, like me, she had never dated anyone. Finally, I thought, I am living with a kindred spirit. I didn't have to worry about her abandoning me halfway into the year, especially not when our apartment was so pretty. It did not for a second occur to me that I would be the one to disrupt the dynamic of our roommateship in its infancy, but that is exactly what happened. Rachel and I moved into our new apartment together on April 1st. Just over 3 months later, I met Lydia. It did not take very long for Lydia and I to start hanging out every day. In the first month or so, we'd grant each other the pretense that we had other things going on, suggesting future dates 3 or 4 nights after the one we were on, as if it were the next time we'd both be free. But you can keep up the illusion of a wide-ranging social life for only so long when you are texting the same person every day and night. Once we started regularly sleeping over at each other's apartments, conveniently, we happened to live exactly 1.5 blocks apart. The jig was up. When either of us asked the other in the morning if she had plans for that night, we told the truth. No, not yet. Not unless it's hanging out with you. In the first 5 or 6 months, I tried to respect Rachel, and by extension, my former self, by making sure Lydia and I slept over at her apartment as many nights as we slept over at mine. The problem was that we agreed. My apartment was much nicer and quieter and closer, even by just 1.5 blocks, to Lydia's job. So then we just started shooting for 2 or 3 nights a week at her place. I never didn't feel guilty when I opened my front door with Lydia behind me and found Rachel at home. She didn't even mind, which almost made it worse. In her position, I had often been so much less forgiving. When Lydia moved into Rachel's and my apartment, about 10 months into our relationship, it mostly formalized something that was already true. Because our apartment is big and because Lydia essentially lived there anyway, it made sense to make it official. We'd known it was coming for a while, I think, but had held out until the practicality of it safely overruled our respective neuroses. Hers, developed after an ex kicked her out after just 3 weeks of living together, that moving into someone else's apartment is a relationship's death knell. Mine, that moving in together before it's been a year, is the same. It wasn't that either of us stopped worrying about these things, exactly, but that we wanted to live together more than we wanted to avoid the potential consequences of it. Lydia found a subletter, and we spent a day hauling her belongings from her place to mine. Or, as I had to get in the habit of calling it, ours. Even before we lived together, I found myself rushing to get home. From work, from the gym, from drinks with a friend, so I could meet up with Lydia. And I am an extremely fast walker. Once, in high school, my friend Tara's boyfriend said he'd seen me somewhere in town, but hadn't said hi to me because I was hauling ass. But that is just my normal walking speed. I hate being in transit. I just want to be there. And usually, there is home. I have never in my life been the last one at a party. The last time I excelled in hangout duration was in high school, the era of sleepovers. Then, my eyes weren't dragged to the clock, calculating what time I'd get home if I left right then. I was stuck there, forced to enjoy myself until morning. So long as I have somewhere else to be and something else to do before I climb into bed that night, it is very hard for me to relax. This is all to say, I rushed home in the days before I met Lydia, too. But with her there, I rushed home even sooner. Sometimes, I would find myself half running to the subway or up to my front door. If she had other plans, that was one thing, but it was hard for me to be out knowing that she was home and I was not. Even still, I sometimes act as though we have a fixed allotment of days together, and I do not want to be responsible for selling us short. Mostly what I think this means is that I am in love. But how bad exactly should I feel for choosing my significant other over my friends? I am certain it's at least a little. Here I must offer a mea culpa for all the times I've said or implied that I would never do that. I retract each instance of single-person sanctimony, and I acknowledge here and now that I did not know what I was talking about when I said I would do friendship differently in a relationship than it had been done to me. I think and I hope that I am still a good friend, but I am not the same friend that I was when I was single. I choose Lydia over friends all the time. I feel bad when I leave parties early or tell a friend I can't hang out for no good reason other than wanting to hang out with my girlfriend instead. Usually, I still do it anyway. I go back and forth constantly between thinking I am getting steadily worse as a person and thinking that this is just what happens when you get older. Worse yet, that both things are true. You get into a relationship, you move in together. You stay in more and go to bed earlier, and your world gets smaller. Having been the person who must be fit into someone else's schedule, given a slot before the boyfriend gets home or on a night he is away, I should have seen it coming. But I did not expect to be part of the problem. I expected my friends to grow flaky and distant when they were in relationships, but not me. I spent so much of my life feeling like I kept my friendships thanks in large part to the strength of my grip. I did not expect that I might one day choose to let go. But I have a girlfriend now, and my friendships are not in place. I have loosened my grip, and not even totally against my will. Falling in love and being in a relationship with someone who is always there has taught me that I don't need my friends as urgently and desperately as I sometimes did when I was younger and alone and afraid I always would be. I still don't know whether that's a good thing. I just know that when I find myself thinking about calling a friend or asking her to hang out and then decide not to, I feel awful every time. And yet I feel more secure in the degree to which I am loved than I ever have before. Lydia and I cook for each other, watch shows together, go to sleep and wake up together. We don't do a whole lot with other people, and half the time, when we do, we end up wishing we'd just hung out alone, together. I am living with the best roommate I have ever had. I met Kiara for a drink a week before she got married. I wasn't going to be at the wedding, which had been a source of some tension between us, and some not inconsiderable guilt on my part. The wedding, fittingly, would be in Italy. I did not go for several reasons, some of them better than others. I didn't think I could afford it, and I knew that Lydia couldn't. My brother was getting married just a month later, and I'd have to travel for that. The wedding involved a Catholic mass, and I wanted nothing to do with a church that said my own relationship was wrong. Weddings in general make me squeamish, though that isn't and wasn't considered a good enough reason in itself not to go. I do not like much about wedding tradition, and having to listen to friends talk about battling in-laws over table settings makes me want to cut off my own head. But that's not a popular opinion, especially not among brides-to-be. It was very difficult for me to be empathetic and kind when Kiara talked to me about her wedding, and I am not proud of it. At the bar, we sat on the patio, shielding our eyes from the sun and sort of dancing around the topics common to someone in the lead-up to their wedding. but it was clear to me that Kiara was restraining herself, and it was probably clear to her that I didn't really want any more detail than she was giving me. Up until I saw her off, I felt secure in my decision not to go. She had been mostly gracious about it and only a little resentful, particularly when I ended up buying plane tickets to Paris for 10 days, 2 months after her wedding, for not all that much.